Welcome to the Maris Review. I'm Maris Kreisman, and I'm joined today by an author who I've enjoyed for many, many years, and I'm so glad he's here today. Dan Shaun is the author of several previous books, including Ill Will, a national bestseller, named one of the 10 best books of 2017 by Publishers Weekly. Other works include the short story collection Stay Awake, a finalist for the Story Prize, the national bestseller Await Your Reply, and Among the Missing, a finalist for the National Book Award. His latest novel is called Sleepwalk. Hi, Dan.
Hey, how are you?
Good. I'm so excited to talk to you.
Yeah.
So I want to start out by asking you what you call the protagonist of Sleepwalk in your head. He has many names.
He has many names, and he calls himself the Barely Blur. And it changed over the course of the novel. In the beginning, I also called him the Barely Blur, and then I started calling him Will. And by the end, I'm calling him Billy in my head. I guess that has to do with like getting closer to him as a person, and then starting to feel a sort of like a paternal sort of friendliness towards him. So that, you know, then I've got his like childhood nickname in my head. But I think you can call him anything he wants.
Okay.
Anything you want.
Well, then for the sake of this interview, I'm going to call him Billy too, because I feel very close to him as well.
Oh, good.
He's one of my favorite kinds of things to see in art and literature, which is the hitman with a heart of gold. Or at least a very developed moral code.
Yeah.
Tell me.
I guess there's something about the idea of somebody who's like living their life in a kind of a sleepwalk, so to speak, or you know, just like in a kind of daze. And that idea of somebody waking up and finding some kind of moral center I'm a sucker for that. It's a sentimental idea, probably. I mean, I think most bad people don't wake up and suddenly decide to become good people. But the idea has always, really touched me. And I'm a sucker for the kind of movies and books where a character is ensconced in their ordinary life and has something that creates an event that suddenly makes them have to make moral choices and have to and sort of break out of the patterns that they're in. Yeah. And I mean, that's definitely what I was going for in this book.
I love that. And I mean, Billy's sleepwalk that he's living in is a great defense mechanism.
Right, because the world around him is pretty awful. I mean, this takes place in a slightly alternate America. Although, as I was writing it, I mean, over the course of about 3 years, the real world inched closer to the dystopia that I had originally imagined. And so I can't even really say that it's science fiction. It's just a little bit different than the US is right now.
It's really something. I was thinking, I assume you've seen footage of the NYPD drone dog.
Yes. Yes.
And it's so disconcerting. And you don't know whether to like try to pet them or run from them or what.
And they're kind of cute, aren't they?
There's, of course, you got the anthropomorphic thing going on.
Right. There's a new product out that's very similar to something that I invented. In the book, there's a kind of drone that flies and follows you around and takes pictures of you and posts them to social media. Turns out that that's an actual thing now. So,
sure.
Of course, I thought it was a clever invention. I didn't patent it though.
You are about to participate in the most ambitious culinary experiment ever imagined.
This competition is going to test everything.
Adapt quickly to anything. I mean anything. The wildest day of your life starts right now.
All new 24 and 24 Last Chef Standing. Sunday night at 8 on Food Network. Stream on Max.
And then, of course, the part of the thing that hurt the most was the idea that newspapers have disappeared. And we are certainly not far from there.
No, I know. I know. We were looking I was in the supermarket checkout line yesterday, and I picked up a copy of the New York Times, and I was just so surprised at how thin it is now. Mm. It's the Sunday New York Times, and I remember, you know, like years ago, you'd pick it up, and it was like a Yule log, you know, it was huge. And now it's just this little kind of slightly withered twig. Mm. And, you know, don't even talk about, you know, like the Cleveland Plain Dealer, which is, you know, kind of a flyer now, if in its print form. It's gone completely online. Very few full-time journalists working for the paper anymore. It's troubling, especially in a world where corruption is so rampant. There's there's no journalistic checks and balances on it, and that I feel is a big part of the reason that we're having so many debates about what's true and what isn't.
Absolutely. And in the book, Billy kind of tells us that, you know, everyone kind of pieces together different versions of reality.
Right, right.
And you have this really upsetting paragraph in which he lists conspiracy theories, quote unquote.
Yeah, can I read that to you?
Yes, please.
All right, this is after somebody tells him that they're worried about Canadian terrorists. I nod thoughtfully. I had not heard about our government's apparent anti-Canadianism, but I don't necessarily disbelieve what friend Dave is saying either. These days, nearly everyone you meet has patched together a different version of reality, depending on which news source and websites and YouTube influencers they've decided to trust. And so my policy is just to listen with an open ear, hoping that there might be some small kernel of truth at the core of what they've come to believe. We're all trying our best to make sense of things. We'd all prefer if the world would just be reasonable and logical, but it refuses. And so even the normally intelligent, such as my daughter, Cammie, even they espouse all kinds of unbelievable notions. After the newspapers started dying, a lot of the things we thought were accepted facts, our shared truths, those started dying as well. And even the fundamentals of science and mathematics, even events that we had been filmed and corroborated by dozens of witnesses, were open to question. Do you think the elementary school shootings in Connecticut were faked and the grieving parents are portrayed by crisis actors? Do you think the crown prince of Saudi Arabia is the leader of an international child sex and torture ring? Do you think that the government dropped cluster bombs containing a psychoactive incapacitating agent over protesters in Chicago after the last election? Do you believe that climate change will destroy the majority of human civilization within the next 12 years? Do you believe in the Holocaust? Well, if you don't, someone does.
I mean, man. And it, after reading that, I was thinking, like, yeah, of course we're all paranoid.
I mean, none of that is even slightly fake.
No. But I do like how it relates to Billy, in that he's had so many different identities that he's always kind of trying to figure out who he is. Like, I am always surprised that he remembers the name that people are calling him.
Yeah. Well, he has all these different phones, and each one of them represents a different character that he's portraying. So he's at least got the he's got the Q there. I never really figured out like when he decides to switch and why. It never really came up, but I feel like he's gotten good at it over the years.
Mm-hmm. And of course, if you don't have a home, as he doesn't,
right?
It becomes much easier to invent yourself along the way.
Right. He lives in an RV that he calls the Guiding Star, which is a sort of tricked out trailer that he drives around the country. And I feel like he has a kind of Zen attitude about what identity is, because mm-hmm. he's in some ways he's never had one. He's always, he grew up with a mother who was a con person and who was always changing their names and changing what their backstory was. So he came by it honestly.
Yeah. and how helpful it is if you increasingly live in a surveillance state, which fantasy or reality, that's something we can't argue with, then going off the grid is increasingly difficult.
Yeah. I think one of the things that makes Billy valuable to his employers is that he was raised as from a child to be somebody that was off the grid. He was raised by sort of paranoid cultists who believed that they needed to raise children that didn't have a birth certificate, didn't have a social security number, had never been online, all of these things. And so he's in some ways this creature that's been created specifically to avoid the surveillance state.
Yeah.
He calls himself a blank Scrabble square because he's a rarity among us.
Yeah. And his mother is such an interesting character. I love how Billy tries not to think about her.
Well, I mean, that's one of the I guess pieces of withheld information that is pulsed through the novel is as we go along, we sort of find out more and more about Billy's relationship and about what happened to his mother.
Yes.
And eventually we find out that there's a really good reason that he's not trying very hard not to think about her.
Yes. And again, what a great coping mechanism. Like he often talks about how not remembering is such a good, helpful tool.
Right. I mean, I was really trying to process something about the way that we're living now. I mean, which is, by all rights, we should all be screaming and weeping and pulling out our hair, but we're not. And I kept thinking about that meme, that the famous meme that went around in the early part of the Trump administration, where the dog is sitting in a coffee shop that's on fire, mm-hmm. Thinking this is fine. Mm-hmm. And I feel like that's in some ways the mascot meme of this book. In some ways it's about somebody waking up and realizing that the house is on fire.
Yeah. And of course, Billy has a role in life as a scammer who was raised by scammers. And so, of course, he won't know who to trust.
Right. That was one of the most exciting things and one of the hardest things about writing this book was he's approached by a young woman early in the novel. He's approached by a young woman who claims to be his biological daughter. And as the result of a sperm donation that he made when he was young. And a big part of it, the middle part of the novel, is this back and forth between the two of them, where she's trying to convince him that she's real. And that process of him sort of letting go of his scammer brain and deciding to accept the possibility of having a connection and a kinship to somebody else. It was the thing that was the most because I had to really believe that it was possible that someone would be that foolish and would take that big of a risk.
He learns what the word catfishing means in the in the course of this, which is probably very helpful. But I think you get into the idea of, like, what does a connection look like if it's not in real life?
Right. Right. And I guess the other thing that was really difficult from a writerly perspective was that so much of the relationship takes place on the phone and through social media. In the way that most of us lived for 2 years, right? Most of our relationships took place virtually or on the phone or on Zoom, and we didn't have a lot of contact with other people. And I can't help but wonder how much that affected our ability to trust. Now that we're back out in the world, we're trying to go back out in the world. It's so strange, you know. Do you say hi to somebody at the supermarket?
I have forgotten how to behave in public for sure.
I know. I guess that was another thing that wasn't entirely intentional when I started the book, but it just sort of, all this stuff kind of dovetailed with the writing of the book and in this weird kind of uncomfortably eerie way sometimes.
It sounds like it. And of course, during the pandemic, dogs were rescued and adopted in increasing numbers. And we know why.
Right.
Tell me a little bit about Flip.
Okay, so Billy's primary companion, as he's driving around the country doing various nefarious things, is a rescue dog, a pit bull named Flip, that he saved from a dog fighting ring. I had such a great time writing a dog as a main character in this. I myself have two dogs. Ray Bradbury and Shirley Jackson are their names. And I spent a lot of time, like Will, talking and interacting with them and anthropomorphizing them, and believing that, in fact, they are really special, highly intelligent beings that kind of know and understand me in ways that nobody else does. And I feel like that's that's Billy's relationship with Flip. And in case anybody is afraid, Flip is not harmed, or he doesn't die. Because that's always my first trigger question. If I'm going to see a movie, I'm like, is a dog gonna die? Because I'm not seeing it.
I do wish I knew going into the book that Flip was going to be okay.
I know. It's not even a good suspense thing. I mean, to like hold out the life of a dog as a suspense, no. You should know from the beginning it's all going to be fine for the dog. I mean, everybody else, it's up in the air. But the dog can't be touched.
It's wild. And then, of course, having Billy connect with Cammy brings up so many questions for him, very much about what does it mean to be related to someone.
It's as a big personal question for me. As an adoptee, I grew up with in a closed adoption, so I didn't know anything about my biological parents. And in my 20s, I searched for my adoptive, my biological parents, and made a connection with my biological father, who I mentioned in the acknowledgments.
Yeah.
But I mean, in some ways, this was a kind of a fictionalized way for me to work through some of that, some of the emotions and some of the process of the weird experience of getting to know someone who's your parent who you've never met before, and all of the kind of amazing connections and the frustrating misunderstandings that come along with that.
Billy kind of recognizes some characteristics in Cammy that he has and that his mother has. Did that happen to you?
Oh yeah, absolutely. Well, I mean, one of the things that was eerie was, even though we'd never met each other, facial expressions were really similar. We have a similar laugh, and that's actually, you know, like a detail in the novel, is that Billy is partially convinced that he's related to Cammy because her laugh sounds so much like his mother's laugh. And you know, even things like the sound of my kids were freaked out because the sound of my bio dad's snoring was the same sound that I make. So it's things that you don't expect. And I think that people, you know, who grow up with their biological parents, are not aware of all of the ways in which, there's this mirroring going on, as you're growing up, and that exists in, you know, it's sort of built into your DNA. It's not something that you're like consciously copying.
Right. It's there. And so it goes back the other way too, of course, that Billy thinks about his mother and what he may or may not have inherited from her.
Right. Right. I think it's safe to say that Billy's mom is really not a nice person.
Yes. That seems justified.
Right. I mean, she's on the sociopath spectrum somewhere. There are definitely, I mean, I think there's definitely a big question in Billy's mind, and in the sort of the questions of the novel is like, how much do we inherit and how much can we escape sort of the destiny of genetics and the destiny of the way that we were raised, to become sort of our own invention. And I feel like that's what that's sort of what the arc of the book is the idea that Billy finally decides to make the choice to try to become his own invention, to try to get out of both nature and nurture in some ways. I guess I'd like to think that's a hopeful idea.
Yes, that we are somehow in control of our own destinies.
Yeah, that like, I mean, I'm not making any super big claims for free will, but I like that, you know, there might be some glimmers of it still.
And along those lines, of course, there's also talk about, especially among Billy and Cammy, the idea of freedom, in that you don't want to be indebted to someone. You don't want someone, quote unquote, owning you.
Right. Right. I mean, the last week has been has been hard for people who were adopted, I think, just because of the the Supreme Court. It's not a ruling, but you know what it is. You know, the leak that was made, and where there's a line about the availability of adoptable infants and the supply. I think the word that's used is supply.
Yes.
And it really makes you feel like a product. And I feel like in this book, Cammy and her cohort, I'm not going to say more than that, are definitely products that are being bought and sold. So there's an element of human trafficking in the novel that I think for some reason is particularly timely right now.
Yeah. Talk to me a little bit about Billy's education. He's clearly an autodidact. Speaks many languages.
Yeah, I mean, he's he's somebody that has never had any formal education at all. And he, at the same time, is one of, as a kid was one of those people that was just constantly hungry to learn. And he has a friend who goes to school from time to time, and he's really jealous of the idea of being able to go to school. And I feel like there are just little grace notes throughout of watching Billy's attempts at being educated, attempts at sort of the touchstone of learning is so real for him. Mm-hmm. And I love his like sort of little rituals of doing the crossword puzzle and the Sudoku and you know, the things that that give him just a glimmer of access to an intellectual life. I'm so glad that you noticed that, because it was like something that really moved me.
Yeah.
That desire to be an educated person. And it's, again, I mean, I guess that's against the backdrop of this world in which knowledge and truth and facts have been so discounted and completely cast aside, which, you know, I mean, along with newspapers, Maris, that's the other thing that we're losing is any kind of respect for knowing things, mm-hmm. for knowledge and education. I mean, we're being taught that education is all sort of indoctrination and politics, and you know, the joy of learning is being lost in the joy of banning books.
Absolutely. All right, I'm going to change up the topic for a second before I ask you for book recommendations. Dan, tell me about writing a minor character who is a chimpanzee.
Oh, I don't want to spoil too much. But okay. Came out of a writing exercise that I had started writing it as a story, and it just started out with a guy walking into a room and a chimpanzee is sitting in a high back chair smoking a blunt. And I thought I was going to write it as like a short for like Smoke Long Quarterly or something. And then it somehow got into the novel and became this huge sort of scene that also brought in stuff about animal experimentation and DNA and growing organs growing human organs in other species and all this stuff that is sort of also floating out there halfway between our real life and science fiction, but becoming more real life every day. Sadly, the guy that got a pig heart transplant died of a pig flu. So there's that.
And as a side note, of course, I love the observation that if you're talking about the novel in which clones are real, or kids in boarding school realize that they are clones made for organ harvesting. So right. Why do they need a private school education? I might have to go back and reread Never Let Me Go because that shook me.
There's a lot of, I mean, I was thinking a lot about, you know, as I'm writing a dystopic novel, I'm reading a lot of, and I'm thinking about all my favorite dystopias, tra-la, and Never Let Me Go just seemed like it was hanging over the book to some extent. So I had to mm-hmm. name check it just so that people knew. Yeah, I know that's out there.
Love it. So what other books would you recommend?
Okay. Can I do something really, a little bit of nepotism? And you know, because this is a novel about fathers and children, I just want to plug the fact that, my son just published his first book. It's with Princeton University Press, and it's called Habitats of the World, A Field Guide for Birders, Naturalists, and Ecologists.
Amazing.
And so I think if you happen to be interested in the ecology and ecosystems of the world, this would be a good book for you to get. And my son's name is Phil Shaun, C-H-A-O-N. I'd also like to talk a little bit about this wonderful writer named Usman Malik, M-A-L-I-K, who published a book called Midnight Doorways, Fables from Pakistan. He has been all over the horror community for a few years now. He's just doing these kinds of stories that feel both really timely and really timeless. They're bringing in a kind of fantasy that I think feels really fresh because it's drawing on a set of mythologies that that American readers at least are probably not as familiar with, and it's also a gorgeous book with beautiful sort of fairy tale like illustrations in it, and I think people that like horror or that like fantasy would love these stories, and I don't feel like it's gotten quite as much attention. It's not published by an American publisher yet. So
all right, then we'll have to look for that.
Yeah, and then I've also been really, really involved in The Candy House, the Jennifer Egan mm-hmm. book. I think it's fine to read The Candy House on its own, but as somebody that really loved A Visit from the Goon Squad and taught that book, I have gone down the rabbit hole of like reading them both together, and I'm like making an appendix where, oh, this character appears here, and then they're in this year, and so like because there's all these different cross references to characters that appear in both The Candy House and A Visit from the Goon Squad, and I feel like they're like deeply interconnected, and so I've gone like full on nerd. I've got like appendixes, like maps, timelines, and to me, that's a great time.
That sounds like the Jennifer Egan cinematic universe.
Exactly.
Dan, thank you so much. Again, the new novel is called Sleepwalk. Thank you.
Yes, thank you so much.
Thank you for listening to the Maris Review, and check the show notes for the books we discussed on here today. And please subscribe wherever you get your podcasts.